The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you know the address, td@kpcg.fm. Well, today we're going to delve into two stories in particular, both of them fairly long pieces, and I think important ones to go through in some detail. But first, just to give a little bit of background or context to this first one that we'll look at. In our literature, often we refer to what came out of the Yalta Conference following World War II, when Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, President Roosevelt and the Prime Minister of Britain, said that it's our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and to ensure that Germany is never again able to disturb the peace of the world. They went on to say in this joint statement that they were determined to disarm and disband all German armed forces. They were going to break up for all time. This is permanent. This was a permanent decision, a decision that would continue on for all time, to break up the German general staff, this military machine that had repeatedly contrive the resurgence of German militarism. They were determined to remove or destroy all German military equipment, even, and even to eliminate or control German industry so that German industry couldn't be used for military production. Well, Winston Churchill, he believed he had history on his side. He believed that a strong Germany was dangerous, pure and simple. Even if the world might look peaceful, a strong Germany is dangerous. And this is something that history has shown repeatedly. Churchill wrote in his history, The World Crisis, he said, this is speaking of those who argued that, well, a civilized Germany, a Germany that rearms, it's not going to be a threat to the West. They're our friends now. They're now an ally. Well, this is what Churchill said about those who were so eager to help build up this German military machine. He said they sound so very cautious and correct. These deadly words, soft, quiet voices purring, courteous, grave, exactly measured phrases in large, peaceful rooms, but with less warning cannons had opened fire, and nations had been struck down by this same Germany. It's too foolish, too fantastic to be thought of in the 20th century. Or is it fire and murder leaping out of the darkness at our throats, torpedoes ripping the bellies of half-awakened ships, a sunrise on a vanished naval supremacy, and an island well guarded hitherto, at last defenseless? No, it's nothing. No one would do such things. Civilization has climbed above such perils. The interdependence of nations in trade and traffic, the sense of public law, the Hague Convention, liberal principles, the Labor Party, high finance, Christian charity, common sense have rendered such nightmares impossible. And then Churchill says, are you quite sure? Are you quite sure? It would be a pity to be wrong. Such a mistake could only be made once. Once for all. And that's all the more so true today, with the weapons of mass destruction available. The weapons of mass destruction at man's fingertips. If you get this wrong once, that's it. That's it. Well, this first piece comes from War on the Rocks. It's by a professor. Let's see, I have it later in my notes here. Well, I'll come to it. Oh, Professor John Denny, a research professor at the U.S. Army War College, War College's Strategic Studies Institute. And it's a lengthy piece here about Germany embracing Realpolitik. Once more, it says, Realpolitik is, well, it has to do with a foreign policy that's based on power rather than ideals. And so Germany is embracing this Realpolitik once more. History's repeating itself, he brings out. I mean, and here's another earth-shaking development foretold in the pages of your Bible. It's also on the pages of history books, as Churchill brought out. Is this a good thing? Germany rearming? Germany building up its armed forces? Well, like Churchill said, together with President Roosevelt coming out of the Yalta Conference, this is something that has repeatedly risen up to cause so much harm for the world. This professor here, Professor John Denny, he says here that recently, it's basically a comparison, this paper that came out earlier this year, the German White Paper, and it's one of the first, at least lengthy, articles that compares this one from 2016 with the last one that came out in 2006. And, of course, we've made the comparison, particularly Richard Palmer, our own trumpet writer and contributor to Trumpet Hour on most Fridays. But he's talked about some of the differences between these two papers and just showing the direction that Germany is in. You can look back now. You have a paper that's 10 years old to compare it to, and you see how very different today is from the way that it was in 2006. This professor here says the recently released German Defense White Paper, or Weißbuch, represents, that's a German word for it, represents a significant step toward or forward in Germany's ongoing transformation to a normal power. It has the word normal in quotes. Germany's ongoing transformation to a normal power. In other words, it's going to function, it's going to operate, it's going to act in a very similar way to what other nations do. Russia, China, the United States. It says, although it has received limited attention in the Anglophone media, the Weißbuch marks a fundamental shift in several respects. That's astounding when you think of it. Given what Churchill and Roosevelt said coming out of World War II and what Churchill wrote in his works of history. And then today we see this transformation, this radical transformation happening, and it barely gets any attention. And yet it represents a fundamental shift, a fundamental transformation, you might say. Well, as I say, this professor goes and he compares the 2016 paper with the one from 10 years ago. And, of course, 10 years ago, if you look back at 2006, at that time, Germany, and to some extent, it still has a relatively short track record of exercising power abroad. But that's beginning to change. And it's happening fast. But going back to that 2006 paper, there were references there to the so-called short track record, Germany's involvement in the joint involvement in the international interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo. We had a lot to say about that. In Germany conquering the Balkans, how that Germany stood up in the 1990s. It may not have had the military force as yet, but it certainly was pushing its political weight around in Europe. And the whole world was against what happened in the Balkans there. But Germany wanted to break it up. And the United States led the way with its military might. It says here in this piece, these experiences informed Germany's decision to participate in NATO's mission in Afghanistan, which was also sanctioned by the United Nations and well underway by 2006. However, so this is what Germany was involved in, the Balkan Wars, Afghanistan. It says here, however, like several other allies, Germany imposed strict caveats on where and how its forces in Afghanistan could be used. This amounted to an incremental acceptance of Germany's shifting role in the world. See, they were just happening in little baby steps, and really, you didn't even hear about them anywhere except at thetrumpet.com. These baby steps. Germany behind the Balkan Wars. Germany's involvement in Afghanistan. Only the Trumpet, really, was sounding the alarm on this. And what it's amounted to, as he brings out here, is this incremental acceptance of Germany's shifting role in the world. People have just accepted it now, and even encouraged it, as we'll see a little bit later. He says it evinced a readiness to see that role broadened through, for example, participation in military missions far beyond Europe, but an unwillingness to do so outside the confines of multilateralism and the legitimacy conferred by international sanction. This careful balancing act is manifest in the 2006 white paper. So you can see from the 2006 paper that they were beginning to warm up to the idea of intervening in international affairs. But there were careful strictures put on their movements. And all of these baby steps, these incremental steps toward acceptance, they were covered at thetrumpet.com. Go back and run a search on any of these. Look at Zu Gutenberg's stint as defense minister. And even the way Germany was changing its rhetoric, the language it used with its involvement in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Professor Denny says here, in many respects, the 2016 Vice book is similarly a product of its time, yet the times have changed dramatically in the last decade. And with them, so too has Germany's perception of its role in the world. A lot has happened in the last 10 years, this professor says. A lot has happened. And then just in the last couple of years, he goes on and says that the seeds of these changes were planted 2 years ago when Germany's president, foreign minister, and defense minister each argued that it was time for their country to take on greater responsibility in international security. Here again, this was a big topic at thetrumpet.com back in those early months of 2014 when we were saying, look at what they're saying. Look at how these German leaders are talking. This hasn't happened since the days following World War II. This professor here says, those important initial rhetorical steps clearly found a more detailed articulation in the 2016 Vice book, which repeatedly emphasizes the themes of responsibility and leadership. And so what started as rhetoric in 2014, now it's the blueprint. Now it's there in the Vice book, the white paper. The 2016 white paper. And it represents a paradigm shift in two important respects, this professor says. When you compare it to the 2016 work, or the 2006 work, sorry, the one 10 years ago, he says, first, the latest Vice book acknowledges the possibility of Germany joining in coalitions of the willing in response to collective security crises. Indeed, the Vice book acknowledges an increasingly obvious reality. Ad hoc cooperation will continue to gain significance as an instrument of international crisis and conflict management. It says here, that's a brief quote from the white paper itself. And then Professor Denny says, what is perhaps most significant is the declaration that Germany will be willing to not simply participate in, but also to initiate such coalitions. This is a major departure from the past, in which Germany consistently sought to exercise hard power solely through established multilateral institutions. So here is where we are today, with Germany moving, and moving fast, to initiate exercising hard power. That's where we are, going back to the title of his piece, Germany Embraces Realpolitik. Once more, history's repeating itself. Germany is embracing this, and the rest of the world is applauding it. It says further here, in some ways we've already seen this change put into practice. For example, witness the German action since 2014 to arm and train Kurdish forces in Iraq, or participating in the anti-ISIS coalition, admittedly with caveats, but outside the scope of the UN mandate or a NATO mission. So it's expanding. It's expanding. It says these are emblematic of the major changes underway in both the theory and practice of German security policy. That's really what this new white paper brings out, that the theory and practice of German security, there's major changes going on. There are major changes happening. He says here, these changes are tied to the second significant element of the paradigmatic shift in German security policy. It says an increasing focus on the role of interests in 2006, and then he makes this comparison here. It's a little tedious, but follow if you can. It says, in 2006, the Weissbuch noted that German security policy is driven by the values set forth in its basic law and by the goal of safeguarding the interests of our country. In contrast, the 2016 Weissbuch states German security policy is tied to values and guided by interests. This may seem like a relatively minor change in tone, but the altered formulation is actually quite noteworthy. The 2006 language clearly subordinates German interests to German values by noting that security policy is driven by values. In 2016, that relationship has flipped. Now German security policy is guided by interests and merely tied to values. Well, it goes on and gives an example, comparing it to the United States, which prides itself on spreading freedom and Western values. But as he brings out later on in his piece, the United States, in the interest of protecting its own interests, will sometimes check values at the door and put up with dictators, for instance, so long as it's serving America's interests. Well, Professor Denny says here, the 2016 Weissbuch makes it clear that Germany is now joining that club, committing itself to a more pragmatic role in the world. And he says here, finally, just as Germany is becoming a more normal country, normal in quotes, it is also confirming its role as the European Union's prime mover and indispensable country. That's from, again, Professor John Denny, a research professor at the U.S. Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute, with his article on Germany embracing Realpolitik. Germany's embracing its militaristic past. Now, what makes this transformation all the more stunning, as I alluded to a moment ago, is that you have many in the West, particularly the United States, that have been pushing for this. As Herbert Armstrong brought out decades ago, we played through several of these clips just a couple of weeks ago, the ones about the Frankenstein monster. That's what we've created. This Frankenstein monster that's going to come back on us. President Obama said a few years ago, he was telling Angela Merkel, don't hide behind your history. Don't hide behind it. Act. Act in accordance with your importance. Step forward and act. And then, of course, this year, the president said to Europe, European nations, look, You've got to rise up and look after your own security concerns. We can't take care of everything. And I played for you yesterday what Donald Trump said earlier this year, how that NATO's obsolete. Just as NATO's on the down and out, Germany is on the rise, and you see it in this 2016 white paper. Pretty amazing. And who was there all the way through telling you about all of these incremental steps? Going back to the 1990s with the Balkan Wars. Going back to Germany's involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. And then ramping up the rhetoric in 2014. And then now this paper. And when you compare it to the one 10 years ago, it really does give us a complete picture of where Germany is headed. Only the trumpet has given you this forecast through and through. And even before us, you go back to some of those clips from Mr. Armstrong from back in the 1950s and 60s. It's remarkable just how spot on that prophetic forecast was. I'll play for you one example, from the 1960s. This is his old radio program, clip 5.
Now, we fought a war against Germany, World War II, and Japan. Of course, we said at the beginning of World War II that we would certainly do away with German militarism and it would never rise up its ugly head again. We were going to demolish it once and for all, and after we got it demolished, now we start to rise it up ourselves because we think we have to have it as a buffer and a protection against Russia. And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
That's pretty amazing. That is amazing, that quote. Now, I mean, we see it, and we know what's prophesied, but we're seeing it. There's only the one nation that's capable of dominating, and it's already the dominant power in Europe. And it's the big push behind the formation of a European military force, as we've been discussing so often on this program over the last couple weeks. So much is happening right now. Brexit in June, the white paper comes out, all this talk, these plans now for a European army, and people applauding it. People on the sidelines or from the stands applauding it. And what did Churchill have to say about those? Well, they sound so very cautious and correct. Soft, quiet voices, purring, courteous, grave, exactly measured phrases in large, peaceful rooms. And then later in that quote, he says to those voices, those soft voices, "Are you quite sure? It would be a pity to be wrong. Such a mistake could only be made once." You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG. If you'd like to email the program, send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. When we come back, I'll get into this other lengthy piece that I wanted to examine. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
And welcome back to the program. This next piece that I wanted to draw your attention to, it comes from the Weekly Standard. It's by it's a long one by Stephen Hayes and Thomas Jocelyn. The title is The Disgraceful Gitmo Exodus, and it gives us quite an insight into this administration's efforts. Of course, you know from President Obama's campaigning, even before he became president in 2009, that he'd vowed to come in and have Gitmo, or the Guantanamo prison in Cuba, to have that shut down after a year. And as Hayes and Jocelyn point out, he came in and found out right away just how hard that was going to be. But he's pushing hard now, right at the end of his administration, to empty it out. And as is brought out in the title of this piece, it is disgraceful when you see how this is happening and who is being let free. You read this article, and at least in my case, I think of America Under Attack, my father writing in there that the attack starts from within. And that's what we're seeing. So many of these prisoners returning to the battlefield and killing more people. Let me take you back to the start of President Obama's administration. This is what he had to say early on in 2009 about his desire to close down Guantanamo. This is clip one.
There's also no question that Guantanamo set back the moral authority that is America's strongest currency in the world. Instead of building a durable framework for the struggle against Al-Qaeda that drew upon our deeply held values and traditions, our government was defending positions that undermined the rule of law. In fact, part of the rationale for establishing Guantanamo in the first place was the misplaced notion that a prison there would be beyond the law, a proposition that the Supreme Court soundly rejected. Meanwhile, instead of serving as a tool to counter terrorism, Guantanamo became a symbol that helped Al-Qaeda recruit terrorists to its cause. Indeed, the existence of Guantanamo likely created more terrorists around the world than it ever detained.
That's President Barack Obama in May of 2009 saying that Guantanamo was a symbol, and all it was doing was helping Al-Qaeda recruit terrorists. And it's creating more terrorists around the world than those that we've detained. So he came in with these lofty goals, prepared to act on his idealism, to empty it out. But he soon discovered, as Stephen Hayes and Thomas Jocelyn bring out in their article, that, I mean, the ones that were left there, and President Bush had let quite a few go, even before President Obama showed up. And the ones that were left, I mean, they were the worst of the lot. They were the Al-Qaeda leaders. They were the top Taliban officials. These were ones who helped plan 9/11, even. These were ones who were caught plotting follow-on attacks. These were ones who were caught preparing for the next wave of attacks. And so it's been it's been a real challenge for this president with a Congress that's been, you know, resisting against these moves. But he has continued on, and you see where he is more toward the end of his administration now, or the end of his presidency, with the more recent interviews that he's offered. The one in this piece that Hayes and Jocelyn draw attention to, it happened in December of last year, December 14th, 2015, an interview, I forget the name of the reporter. However, it was something that had to do mainly with Cuba, and so coming out of this interview, it went on for, I think, more than 20 minutes. Most of the sound bites and the clips and the news coverage from that particular interview in December of 2015, most of it concentrated on normalizing, or the wish to normalize, relations with Cuba. And then, of course, following that, there was the visit to Cuba earlier this year. So that got all of the headlines. But as these two journalists bring out in this excellent piece, I mean, this wasn't the only thing that should have made news at the time. It says it was instead the president's attempt. I'm picking it up in the middle of the thought here in this article. But what was brought out in that exchange with that interviewer in December of 2015 was that the president was going to mislead the American people in order to accomplish this objective. This is that's not a direct quote from the president, but that's what we can take from it. These two journalists bring out. Here's a short excerpt from that interview. This is December 14th, 2015, clip two.
I am absolutely persuaded, as are my top intelligence and military advisors, that Guantanamo is used as a recruitment tool for organizations like ISIS. And if we want to fight them, then we can't give them these kinds of excuses.
Now, what Hayes and Jocelyn bring out is that there's really no evidence to support the fact that this is somehow a significant recruiting tool. And these two guys say that national security experts from across the political spectrum have tested that claim, and they've judged it to be false. It's not true. But that's what the president stated. December 14th, 2015, he went on and said this. This is clip three.
Keep in mind that between myself and the Bush administration, hundreds of people have been released. And the recidivism rate, we anticipate. We assume that there are going to be, out of 400, 500, 600 people that get released, that a handful of them are going to be embittered and still engaging in anti-U.S. activities and trying to link up potentially with their old organizations.
So he anticipates the fact that the recidivism rate would just be a handful of the hundreds and hundreds that are released. And here again, Hayes and Jocelyn point out how that this has been proven false as well. They write, when Obama made this claim, 653 detainees had been released, and of that group, 196 had been either confirmed or suspected. There were 117 confirmed, and then 79 have been suspected of returning to jihadist activity. So if you just take the 117, I mean, that's a huge chunk from 653 released. 117 that have been confirmed to return to jihadist activity, and another 79 suspected. Those numbers, it says, came from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and represents the U.S. government's official count of Guantanamo recidivism. That means those that return to the battlefield. Nearly one in three former detainees returned to the fight. Not a handful, as the president suggested. So he said in that interview back in December last year that, look, the recidivism rate, we anticipate there's going to be a handful, but this is worth it. It's worth it. We don't want to give them an excuse. First, it was, of course, Al-Qaeda in 2009, because ISIS didn't exist yet. Now it's ISIS. We don't want to give them excuses that allow for them to recruit more terrorists. So we've got to let these criminals go. And we know that a few of them are going to still be embittered and return to the battlefield. In fact, it's nearly 1 in 3. Well, it went on to quote President Obama in this article. I didn't get this particular clip here, but he also said in that interview that the bottom line is that the strategic gains we make by closing Guantanamo will outweigh those low-level individuals who've been released so far. And this was another lie. So many of them are not, particularly as you whittle it down to the last 70, 80, 90 ones that are there. These are not low-level individuals. Hayes and Jocelyn say again, this is false. The U.S. government under George W. Bush and Barack Obama has released dozens of veteran jihadists whose terror resumes include senior positions in al-Qaeda and like-minded groups. And of course, Obama had himself transferred 5 senior Taliban officials to Qatar in order to secure the release of Bo Bergdahl. We know how that went down. 5 senior Taliban officials. Hardly low level. It says, so at the time of escalated threat levels from international terrorists, the President of the United States is releasing dangerous jihadists against the advice of the military and intelligence professionals who have studied the threat for years, and he's lying to the American people to downplay the threat. There's just a handful, and they're all low level. It's sort of like what he says with those he lets out of U.S. prisons. They're just a low level type, someone that smoked marijuana once. And then you start looking at the rap sheets of these individuals that are being let go. It's the same kind of mentality here. Only the agenda behind this, of course, is to close down Guantanamo completely. Because terrorists, he believes, are using it as an excuse to get more recruits. Notice this here, though. Hayes and Jocelyn said, that's news. Well, going back to that statement, the fact that it's not true, it can be proven false, which shows that he's lying to the American people to downplay the threat. That is news, these two write. And yet a review of press briefings, transcripts from the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House over the 2 weeks after President Obama's claims shows that his interview did not generate a single follow-up question, not one. This is a breaking story. This is a newsworthy development. And you look at the transcripts at the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House, in the weeks following that interview in mid-December 2015, and there's not been one follow-up question from a reporter who's even curious about, well, you say a handful, but how do you explain the 196 that the Director of National Intelligence has already been out there describing as having gone back into the battlefield? As having returned to jihadist activity. Not one question. No one that's come forward and said, well, you say low level, but what about these guys? The 5 high level, top level Taliban officials, senior officials that you released for Bo Bergdahl. And he says here, hence the president having paid no cost for misleading the American people on such a crucial matter of national security is moving forward undeterred. Well, there's nobody to stop him. Nobody even questions his actions. And so he moves forward undeterred. The spirit of Antiochus, it's strong in Washington. Vice President Joe Biden at the press conference in Stockholm late last month said his hope and expectation is that Guantanamo will be closed by January 20th, 2017. That's their hope. That's their expectation. And the media is completely silent. The president's paid no cost for misleading the American people, and so he moves forward, undeterred, creating false narratives as he goes. It's amazing when you think of the media and the things they do get worked up about. You probably saw some bits in the news on, what was it, last Friday, I guess, when Donald Trump said that he was going to announce or have a big announcement on the birther issue. The media is ready to pounce on him because for many years he was out there suggesting that the president was not born in the United States. And so he put off his comments and had them go to his brand new hotel in Washington, D.C., I think it was, and all the media gathered there for the big announcement. And it ended up just really putting a lot of publicity or getting a lot of publicity for his new hotel and for Donald Trump himself. Because in that 30-minute press conference, the first 25 minutes or so, you just had all these war veterans coming up talking about how great Donald Trump was, offering their endorsement to Donald Trump. And then finally at the end, Donald Trump stepped forward and said, look, President Obama was born in the United States, end of story, now let's move on. And that was it. That was the end of it. And all of these reporters were just fuming. They got played, many reported. They were angry. They were not going to try to give any publicity to this new hotel, given that Donald Trump comes forward and all of these live feeds were going, and then there's these people just heaping praise on Donald Trump. And then they finally get the statement that they want to get into, and he doesn't offer any questions. It's as matter of fact as anything, and he closes the door on it. And the media got played, and they were upset. They were angry. They were tweeting about it. They were writing about it. They were reporting about it. They don't want to get played, not by Donald Trump. But with President Obama, that's a different story. All along with the Iran nuke deal, to take another example, they totally got played. Ben Rhodes announced that in May earlier this year. And not a peep from the major media. Not a peep. In fact, the New York Times was happy to repeat the false narrative even after Ben Rhodes admitted it was false. Well, they just continue on with the lies. How many in the media are right on board? How many of them are right on board with the president's agenda with respect to Guantanamo? Here he's putting out these false claims and not one follow-up question. And so he moves forward undeterred. No one to stop him. No one to even slow it down. It says here, this is back to Hayes and Jocelyn's piece, in recent weeks, the Obama administration has transferred from Guantanamo al-Qaeda operatives who were working directly for the men who planned the 9/11 attacks. We just passed the 9/11 anniversary. 15 years. 15 years. That's all that it's taken. That's all the time that these men put in behind bars. 15 years. And now they're being let go. Men who work directly with those who planned 9/11. It says Obama's periodic review board has approved for transfer a veteran jihadist who was identified in the 9/11 commission report as an individual who recruited 9/11 hijackers in Germany. These are not low-level individuals, not by a long shot. Says the administration is preparing to release or transfer many remaining jihadists judged by U.S. military and intelligence professionals to be high-risk. High-risk detainees who would almost certainly return to the fight if freed. Well, there's quite a lot of examples and details, again, that it gets into. One more statement here. As the administration's urgency increases, so will its deception, and so too will the dangers to the American people. See, there's all the more urgency now because they're coming down to the last few months of President Obama's second term. And so the urgency intensifies, and so does the deception. This is one of many reasons why we've got to keep, as I said a week or two ago, we've really got to keep our eyes on this administration, this so-called lame duck administration, these next few months. Well, the article goes on to just in talking about some of the ones that are being let go. This Ramzi Benalshib, he was caught back in 2002, a year after 9/11, along with others who became known as the Karachi Six. They were apprehended in Pakistan. And these were individuals that, again, worked with 9/11 planners, some of them with close ties to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the chief architect of 9/11. And when these six were caught, President Bush, back in 2002, I mean, he praised their capture, saying, we've got some bad guys here, and they're going to be locked up. Well, the article says a little bit later, since the beginning of this year, at least five members of the Karachi Six have been approved for transfer by the Obama administration. That's happening this year. These are the so-called low-level individuals that are being let go. Two of the Karachi Six, including the man captured at the side of this planner and organizer of the September 11th attack, Ramzi Benalshib, were sent to the United Arab Emirates in August when the Department of Defense announced their transfer from Guantanamo, along with 13 others. It thanked the UAE for its humanitarian gesture and willingness to support ongoing U.S. efforts to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. The implication was clear, says Hayes and Jocelyn. It was inhumane for the United States to continue holding the jihadists. See, they said to the UAE, thank you for this humanitarian gesture. Thank you for helping us to close Guantanamo Bay. And so they let five of these six, the Karachi Six, they let them go. The article goes on and talks about how earlier on in Obama's administration, that Obama's own people identified just how dangerous many of these individuals were left in Guantanamo. But that started to change, and it happened fast. It says then, this is the article, then suddenly, in late 2015, so that's about a year ago, which takes us back to that critical interview in December 2015, which most people ignored, or at least the part about Guantanamo they did. Everybody got caught up in Cuba. It says, then suddenly, in late 2015, the Obama administration reversed these conclusions, describing four of the Karachi Six as merely low-level, low-ranking fighters. Multiple publicly available documents illustrate how the Obama administration changed the analysts' assessments. I mean, they got in there and they changed the assessments that their own government had given. All because of this agenda. The end justifies the means. Just change the books, call them low level when they really are high level, because we've got to empty it out. It doesn't matter what the narrative is. It doesn't matter how much of it is true or not. What matters is that we close down this detention facility. That's the thinking. That's the mindset, clearly. Well, it gets into quite a lot of detail on how that those changes were made. Now, all of a sudden, they're low level. It says here, later on, simply put, the Obama administration is transferring many of the detainees the administration itself previously deemed to be the worst of the worst, including at least five members of the Karachi Six and the man long suspected of recruiting some of the 9/11 hijackers. This administration is so desperate. It so desperately wants to close the detention facility in Guantanamo that we're letting out individuals that helped recruit some of the 9/11 hijackers. Well, let me see if I can hurry along here and get to the end. It talks later on in the piece about how that even some of the countries that are helping to take some of these prisoners, the UAE, for example, or Qatar, we mentioned earlier, how that the administration has been less than truthful with them as well. Because in order for these countries to open up their doors, I mean, some of their officials are saying, well, we don't want them if they're going to be dangerous. We don't want them if they're high-level Taliban officials. And then here comes the Obama administration saying, hey, don't worry. Don't worry. They're all low-level. They're all low-level. And our own people have concluded this. Well, since 2015. There's dishonesty that just runs through it. All the way. All the way. Let me just get to the end here. It says, when the transfer to Ghana was announced, well, this is talking about the transfer of prisoners early this year, January of 2016, how that the U.S. had determined that these individuals, initially they had determined they were committed jihadists, but then that assessment was changed, and basically Ghana, the officials there were deceived. It says, when the transfer to Ghana was announced, however, a statement from the government in Accra claimed the men were detained in Guantanamo but have been cleared of any involvement in terrorist activities and are being released. It says later, it's almost as if the U.S. intelligence assessment and the statement from Ghana are describing different people. How does this happen? How does this happen? Says Jojo Bruce Kwanza, the information minister at Ghana's embassy in Washington, D.C., told us at the time that the U.S. government provided assurances that Bin Atef was never involved in terrorism and presented little risk. If that assurance was not there, he said, there's no way his government would have taken the detainees. So the government, the U.S. government, told them, look, these are innocent guys. They're not that dangerous. They're low level. And so then when Ghana takes them in, having received those assurances, what kind of security, what kind of watchful eye do they put on those hardened criminals once they're there in Ghana or the UAE or Qatar? It's no wonder they're finding it so easy to end up back on the battlefield. Well, just to close the loop with what President Obama has been saying all along, here's what he said more recently. We gave you a clip from the December 2015 interview. Here's what he said in February of this year.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. This is not just my opinion. This is the opinion of experts. This is the opinion of many in our military. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
And that, as Hayes and Jocelyn bring out in their piece, their lengthy piece, is simply not true. They conclude their article by saying, it's not clear today whether the Obama administration will succeed in closing Guantanamo. What is clear is that in attempting to do so, the president is willing to free dangerous terrorists and mislead the American people and our diplomatic partners. Yes, indeed, that much is clear, as I said at the outset of going through this piece. You think of America under attack as you delve into some of these details, shocking details of what's happening right inside the United States. You've been listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us as this week unfolds, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.